This is a download from the BBC. For more information and our terms of use, go to bbc.co.uk/radio3.
I directed my first production at a boarding school in Bristol at the age of 8. It was based on a ghost story my older brother had read aloud to me in the holidays in an attempt to frighten me out of my wits. The attempt, and others like it, was successful. The blood-thickening terror he conjured with his quiet, expressive, 12-year-old voice, dusk falling, the wind dropping in the tall beech trees behind the house, was like a shot of something adult, thrilling and forbidden. When I press-ganged those unfortunates in my dormitory into presenting a version of W.W. Jacobs' The Monkey's Paw at the end of the following term, there were, to my surprise, no objections. I suppose that it was at that moment, unaware even of the term itself, that I became a director. Almost 50 years later, I am still at it. And what have I learnt? It feels like almost nothing at all. Every new project I approach with the nerves of the novice, and every first morning is like the first day at a huge and unfamiliar primary school. My film Hyde Park on Hudson was no exception. It's set in America in the late 1930s, but all shot within an hour of my house in North London. We began propitiously enough one glorious July day at the Getty Estate outside Stoke and Church, a large and beautiful chunk of the Chilterns, famous for its cricket ground, its red kites, and a topography largely unchanged since the 1700s. It also bears a more than passing resemblance to the Hudson Valley in upstate New York, hard by President Roosevelt's family home at Hyde Park on Hudson, the key location of the story. On first days, you try and do easy things. Well, nothing I think is exactly easy, but at least you try to schedule a gentle way into the film. More than 100 people are meeting up, many for the first time, brain-numbingly early in the morning, with a view to collaboratively produce a complicated, expensive, and technically demanding object, that is, a few hundred feet of usable film. This day, day one of 40 such days, has been meticulously anatomised, planned, and anticipated for months. The actual shoot is only the tip of the production iceberg, and as David Mamet has almost reliably pointed out, all mistakes are made in pre-production. On this day, we have decided and prepared to shoot scenes 22, 23, 35 part, 25, 26, and 24, in that order, between the hours of 8 in the morning and 6:30 in the evening. They're all driving scenes and feature the President, his distant cousin, and an exquisite 1935 open-top 5-litre Ford Phaeton, left-hand drive, shiny as an apple, an exact replica of Roosevelt's own car, which we purchased at great expense from a private owner in the US and shipped over. I drive myself an hour up the M40 to set. Although car and driver are on offer, I've learnt over the years to covet this little bit of the day when I'm alone with either my own thoughts or James Noctis. I'm uncharacteristically cheerful and confident. The weather is gorgeous. The scenes and how to shoot them are all carefully sketched out in my head. We've had an excellent rehearsal week, and the various technical recces and preparations have been rigorous and thorough. In short, everyone should know exactly what they're doing, and I can allow myself to almost whistle as I take the Stoke and Church exit and follow the little green location signs to base. A 10-acre field on a gentle gradient rising from valley floor to woodland. But hang on. Why are there so many people? At around £8 million, this is a lowish budget British feature, not Lawrence of Arabia. Have I stumbled upon a parallel universe? There are probably 50 cars marshalled into neat rows running up the gradient, and more arrive in my wake. A man with a kindly face clutching a can of Iron Brew directs me to a distant spot. The field is alive with strangers. At first glance, mostly great knobbly blokes with big boots and armfuls of ancient tats who are rustling around in bright orange high-vis jackets, chewing on bacon rolls and laughing comfortably at each other's banter. Further up the hill, intimidating traders for makeup, wardrobe and actors are parked up next to evil-looking mobile toilets, to generators in their blimped lorries, and to sundry camera, lighting and grips trucks. A camera tracking vehicle, festooned in rusting scaffold like an infernal machine from a Mad Max movie, is being backloaded off its trailer by a trio of beach bums smoking fat roll-ups while shouting at each other. One of them sports bandana and shades, like the evil twin of Dennis Hopper in Easy Rider. From a small cluster of pop-up tents, a plume of breakfast-flavoured smoke curls up into the sky. It's like a nightmare hybrid of an illegal Essex traveller's encampment, rock festival, and car boot sale. And somehow, I am culpable for it all. I get out of the car, put on my boots, then check the contents of my rucksack. Script, script notes, storyboard, call sheet, biro, banana. Then feeling pathetically like a cheerful idiot about to lead his lads over the top at Vimy Ridge, I wander up the hill, hoping to recognise someone. Anyone will do. There's Barry, my first AD, my right hand, arm and leg. This is our fourth film together. He's a tough Scottish nut, but inside I know that he too is nervous as a kitten. He chooses this moment to remind me of a story about a director who, on his way to another first day, reflected that he would rather be run over by a car than face a film crew that morning. Nothing fatal, you understand, but just enough. In the breakfast queue are more new faces. Who are they? And how can they possibly stomach such huge plates of sausages, rashers, char-grilled toast piled high with scrambled eggs and tomatoes? I force myself to eat a tiny cardboard bowl of muesli with berries. There's something hideous about the feel of the plastic spoon in my dry mouth. Already I'm somehow infantilised, standing in the corner of the playground in unfamiliar shoes watching the bigger children cavort. Around me there is a festive air which I find unpleasant, inappropriate and, frankly, slightly sinister. Slowly the cabals come into focus. The camera department, that is the operators, focus pullers, clapper loaders, cable bashers, these are the wannabe fighter pilots of the group. Their gear is hand-picked, multi-pocketed beige shorts, lightweight bomber jackets over Maker's Mark T-shirts, skateboard shoes in pastel macaroon colours, Ray-Bans, stubble, cool, dashing dudes. Further off, a gang of grips huddle around the espresso machine bolted onto the back of their truck, clutching tiny steaming paper cups in their big hands. They are massively shod, whatever the weather, like plough horses. In the wet, out come huge oiled capes and conical hats that turn them into giant wizards from a Terry Gilliam film. Further down the hill, in the lee of their people carrier, the sound department are not exactly nerdy, but studious. Paradoxically, always the quietest of the clans, they've already started fussing around an orgy of cables, booms, earphones and dials. Over by the electrics trucks, the Sparks are drinking Vimto and sunning themselves. They look knackered, as if instead of starting they've just finished a film, which of course they probably have. With the sun in the sky, there's nothing for them to do for the moment. They are the hardened campaigners, inured to the squalor of filmmaking, already suspicious of us all and the whole earth organic catering we have laid on. They don't care if we like them or not. Unlike the ADs, the midshipmen and subalterns of the group, whose leverage and currency is charm, and who are eagerly mixing it with everyone. We're still an hour from call time, but already they are cheerfully ferrying people and coffee, clutching piles of the day's sides and whispering into their headsets. I go and find the actors in the big makeup trailer. If they're nervous, they don't show it. Bill Murray is having his liver spot stuck on and his FDR teeth fitted. He's cheerful, almost sunny. In fact, I think he's looking forward to this day with a childlike excitement. It's infectious. The atmosphere in the trailer is appallingly relaxed. Loud country music is playing, there's coffee and banter, and Laura Linney is teasing me about my shorts and the green-rimmed shades I picked up at the Oxfam shop. "Now you look like a proper film director," she shouts as I clamber back down onto the grass. God, I don't feel like one. I walk down to the set. Young pheasant cough and chatter in hedgerows crammed with wild flowers. Up above the tree canopy, the red kites are lazily riding the thermals, eyeing us with the contempt I'm sure we deserve. None of this makes me feel any better. At the appointed place, the riggers and grips are hard at work. They're setting up goalposts made out of two lighting stands to capture an overhead shot of the phaeton gliding past below. They're rigging the camera vehicle with aluminium tubing to take a forward-facing Steadicam and its operator, and they're making a further camera ready to go handheld in the back of the hero car, our first setup of the day, and of the film. These scenes, conceived inside my head so long ago, languid, luxurious, floating in sunshine, sit oddly against the means of achieving them, metal, sweat, scaffold, cable. And this paradox lies at the heart of it all. I must trust that film's miraculous alchemy will fashion the one from the other. Martin, car wrangler, brings the phaeton up. It has been in his loving charge for a month now, and he has pampered it like a thoroughbred. It gleams inside and out. We have tested it on all terrains, have put cameras in it, alongside it, and upon it, have let Bill Murray loose on it twice, and it has effortlessly cleared every hurdle. Shortly after 8 o'clock, the actors jump in the front. Lowell, the DP, Derek, the focus puller, and I, clutching a handheld monitor, fold ourselves and our equipment into the back of the open-topped car. Around us, crew circle like technicians making final adjustments to astronauts. A second ND filter for the camera, the microphone in Laura's lapel tweaked, the rake of Bill's hat increased just so, a jot of powder above an eyebrow, a final focus check from hand to ear to gear lever to cigarette. The whole unit now quiet, focused, purposeful. I look in the monitor and see, for the first time, the actors in full makeup and costume, in the glorious car, against the trees, backlit in the early summer sunshine, all within the thrilling confines of a frame. And I'm hit with a rush of excitement. This is going to be all right after all. I look around at the now open faces of the crew, the swarm who over the next days and weeks and months will sharpen into individual focus. Everything goes quiet. I can hear breeze in the treetops, and in the distance, birdsong. In that quiet moment, for the first time, we become one crew. In the stillness, my nerves and self-consciousness evaporate, and I'm suddenly in my element. All those thousands of hours of my life spent in rehearsal rooms, or backstage in dark theatres, or staring at scripts or screens, or conjuring writers, or standing on sets, or trying to frighten the other children at school, all come hurtling to my rescue. After the planning and wrangling and intellectualization, directing is an instinctive act. But instinct is also paradoxically learnt, or at least accreted, through experience. As I get older, I at least begin to sense the ballast that informs every one of the hundreds of thousands of judgments that allow a film to come to life. Barry calls it. Sound speed, echoes faintly from the undergrowth. The clapperboard, magic jaws into another world, is presented to the camera. Day one, slate one, take one, clap. A short, momentous pause, then, for all to hear.
Action!
The car shudders. The 32nd President of the United States dabs the throttle, and instantly the engine cuts out with the sort of rattle normally associated with deathbeds.
Cut! Hold the roll!
Etc., etc. An hour later, we're all still standing in a loose circle around a number of white-faced mechanics who are armpit-deep in 80-year-old engine parts. Is it the coil, the carburetor, or the fuel line? And every minute we're not shooting is like a dagger in my heart. If you see the film, look out for the careless, summer sun-filled driving sequences, and you will, I'm sure, detect no trace of our pain. But then, nothing prepares you for those first days. However well they end up going, you still feel like you've been hit by a truck.